Good evening. David is still not feeling well tonight, so I was asked to stand in for him. I know Zach is soon going to be starting to teach Hebrews, so I thought perhaps we might look a little tonight at some things about Jewish history, because I know we'll be talking a lot about that sort of thing when we get to Hebrews and looking back at particularly at the Old Covenant. In fact, I have an entire series of lessons on that topic, and this is one that I have pulled out that I thought might be interesting for tonight. What I want to look at tonight is the second greatest source of Jewish history. All right, well, the first greatest source of Jewish history is the Bible. We are going to talk about the Bible tonight, but I wanted to focus on the second greatest source of Jewish history, which is this book right here, The Works of Josephus. The Works of Josephus. If you've grown up in the church as I have, you've heard a lot about Josephus. He's cited a lot, and there's a reason for that, is that he is, in fact, the second greatest source of Jewish history. Very commonly cited. Of course, it is an extra-biblical source, which means it's not part of the Bible, which means he is not inspired, but yet he can still be informative, as you know any type of history book could be. What I want to look at tonight is, who was he? I mean, we've heard his name all our lives. Who was he? What did he write? Why did he write it? When did he write it? That sort of thing. And we're going to, of course, look at how what he wrote relates to what we find in the Bible. Flavius Josephus, we'll talk in a moment why he has the name Flavius, which is obviously a Roman name. He was born in around AD 37, which, of course, was just shortly after the crucifixion. He was the son of a priest. He grew up in Jerusalem. He was very acquainted with all the Jewish feasts, the Jewish religion, of course. He was very acquainted with a lot of the background figures we see in the Bible, such as King Herod, Pontius Pilate, the Pharisees, the Sadducees. He was intimately acquainted with all of them. For a while, he was associated with the Essenes, which we don't really see, at least by name, in the New Testament. I think there's an oblique reference to them. But they're not mentioned by name. They were the ones that gave us the Dead Sea Scrolls. And Josephus was briefly associated with them when he was around 19. When he was 26, though, he traveled to Rome. Why? He traveled to Rome to plead for the release of some priests who had been arrested and were being tried by Nero. But he went to Rome. What we're going to find about Josephus is that he knows a lot about the Jews, of course, but he also knows a lot about Rome. This was his first trip to Rome. He makes other trips. When he returned to Jerusalem, he was very impressed with Rome, with Roman might and power. And Josephus was very much opposed to any revolt by the Jews. He tried to restrain the various rebellions that were forming. Eventually, he joined one of them, though, and he commanded a small force in Galilee. And he was captured and he was imprisoned. But during his imprisonment, he gained the favor of Vespasian. Vespasian was the Roman emperor ruling at the time Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70. Vespasian was the father of Titus and Domitian. You may recall Domitian. We talked a lot about him in our class on Daniel. Anyway, Vespasian became emperor. Josephus was freed from prison, and he returned to Jerusalem, and he worked for Vespasian's son, Titus, who later became emperor himself. So here we have someone, Josephus, who was born into a family of priests, intimately familiar with all the Jewish history, the Jewish customs, the Jewish feasts, all the Jewish groups, and he is a confidant to Roman emperors. So a very interesting person right there in his own personal history. Very interesting. Around AD 70, Josephus tried to convince the Jews to surrender. He did not want them to fight the Romans. Of course, he was unsuccessful in doing that. As we know, the city was destroyed, temple was destroyed. Josephus then returns to Rome as a Roman citizen, and he adopts the name of the emperor's family, Flavius. So he is Flavius Josephus. And it's at that point he started writing everything down. So that's when he started writing his books. His first work was called The Wars of the Jews. By the way, you can pick up a copy of this at nearly any bookstore or on Amazon, I suppose, and all the books I'm talking about are in here. So this, although it's just one book, all of his books are in here. And his first work is The Wars of the Jews, which covers the time from the Maccabees up to the war with Rome. Now, you remember about the Maccabees. We also talked about them when we studied Daniel and all that history that Daniel prophesied about between Daniel and and the first century. That included the Maccabees. Daniel had a lot to say about them. That book by Josephus starts with the Maccabees and goes up to the war with Rome. He has eyewitness accounts in there of various things. So, I mean, you know, it's not like a historian always writing about things he didn't see personally. Josephus does some of that, of course, because he wasn't alive to see the Maccabees. But he also writes about some things he did see personally. So we have eyewitness accounts in the books of Josephus. He starts that book by recounting the Jewish rebellion against Antiochus Epiphanes. You may recall that from the book of Daniel and the study of Daniel also. Antiochus Epiphanes was a great enemy of Rome. Well, why does Josephus start by recounting a rebellion against Antiochus? Because Josephus wants Rome to know that, well, now the Jews were not always against you. At one point, they were against the same person you were against, Antiochus Epiphanes. In fact, they were very courageous there, and that's why Josephus starts there and writes that part. Throughout the book that Josephus writes, he is trying to change the hatred of the Jews that existed throughout the empire. That's kind of the underlying theme throughout the entire works of Josephus. He describes Jewish culture. He describes Jewish history. He's an apologist for the Jews. He's trying to change that hatred of the Jews that existed in the empire. He complains that most of the histories of the time in Rome were very anti-Jewish, which is certainly the case. And about those works, I like what Josephus wrote. He said, "They desire to represent the Romans as a great nation, and yet they continually depreciate and disparage the action of the Jews. But I fail to see how the conquerors of a puny people deserve to be accounted great." In other words, if you're trumpeting how you conquered us, then you shouldn't at the same time be saying we're a puny people, because that kind of contradicts each other. So Josephus was trying to build the Jews back up. His other major work, and in fact his longest work, is called The Antiquities of the Jews, and he wrote that about 20 years later after the Wars of the Jews. That Antiquities of the Jews presents a history of the Jews starting from the very earliest times. Well, what was the purpose of that book? The purpose of that book was to convince the Greeks that the Jews had a greater history than they did. I'm not sure the Greeks were convinced, but they should have been, right? So that was the purpose of that book. Now, an appendix to the Antiquities was called The Life of Flavius Josephus, which may have been the first autobiography that we know about, I mean, very early anyway. In that work, he defended himself and his war record against an unflattering portrayal that had kind of gotten out in the press. So he was kind of defending his own background there. And his fourth and final work that we have is called Against Appian, which is a defense of the Jewish faith against an Egyptian named Appian. Why should any of this matter to us? Well, the reason it matters to us is that the books of Josephus are a gold mine of information about New Testament times. His works are the principal source for history of the Jews from the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes up until the fall of Masada. That's from 175 BC to 73 AD. Of course, the New Testament tells us some about that latter period, but the former period is in the time between the Testaments. Now, we do know something about that from the Bible because Daniel gave us a very detailed blueprint of what was going to happen in that time. But Josephus fills in a lot of the names and things that were left out there in that prophecy that we studied in Daniel chapter 11. Now, one commentary I like said that if Josephus's writings had not survived, he said most of our Bible dictionaries would be pocket size. I mean, a lot of it comes from Josephus. Josephus has been the archaeologist's constant companion very often. Of course, we know archaeologists often carry around their Bibles because the Bible always tells them where to dig. But Josephus is also very helpful to archaeologists. And, you know, the New Testament people that we see in Josephus, it includes John the Baptist, Jesus himself, James, the brother of Christ. They're all mentioned in the works of Josephus. Now, despite the significance of his writings, and despite the fact that we occasionally quote here and there, they're really largely neglected. I mean, most people haven't picked up and read the entire works of Josephus. I certainly have not. Well, why is that? Well, one, they're big, right? I mean, it's a big book. They're extensive. And the print in here is very small. And in fact, it's larger than the Old Testament. So it's a big, big book. Also, when you read it, he rambles on and on and on a lot of the times. You kind of want to get the abbreviated version, the Reader's Digest version of Josephus. His work, The Antiquities, begins with a paraphrase of the entire Old Testament and then continues with the subsequent Jewish history. Another roadblock is that the most popular English text was translated in 1737, and it's usually printed in double columns, which is what this one is right here. So that may explain why a lot of people aren't picking up and reading it. But yet we've always been so attached to Josephus, right? We continue to quote him and refer to him. Why is that? Well, he provides extraordinary background information for readers of the New Testament. Many of the characters and the places that are just mentioned in passing by the gospel writers are elaborately discussed by Josephus. King Herod, his sons, Pontius Pilate, the high priest, Annas and Caiaphas, the temple in Jerusalem, the region in Galilee where Jesus lived and Jesus taught, the Samaritans, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, you find elaborate descriptions of them in the book of Josephus. So it's very interesting to read when you combine it with what we know from the New Testament. Josephus enjoyed a real surge in popularity during the 12th century. Why was that? Because that was the time of the Crusades. And in fact, most crusaders carried the works of Josephus along as a tour guide as they marched along, killing the very people he had written about. One of the most compelling reasons for the importance of Josephus to the early Christians, though, is the description of the fall of Jerusalem in AD 68 and 70. Again, Josephus was there. He saw this. So we're having an eyewitness account of what was going on. Let me just read you a short section from Josephus on the fall of Jerusalem. So all hope of escaping was now cut off from the Jews, together with their liberty of going out of the city. Then did the famine widen its progress and devoured the people by whole houses and families. The upper rooms were full of women and children that were dying by famine, and the lanes of the city were full of the dead bodies of the aged. The children also and the young men wandered about the marketplace like shadows, all swollen with the famine, and they fell down dead wheresoever their misery seized them. As for burying them, those that were sick themselves were not able to do it, and those that were hearty and well were deterred from doing it by the great multitude of the dead bodies and by the uncertainty there of how soon they should die themselves. For many died as they were burying others, and many went to their coffins before that fatal hour was come. Nor was there any lamentation made under these calamities, nor was heard any mournful complaints, but the famine confounded all natural passions. For those who were just going to die looked upon those that were gone to their rest before them with dry eyes and open mouths. A deep silence also, a kind of deadly night, had seized upon the city. While yet the robbers were still more terrible than these miseries were themselves, for they broke open the houses, which were no other than graves of dead bodies, and plundered them of what they had, carrying off the coverings of their bodies, and went out laughing. That's the fall of Jerusalem that Jesus talks about in Matthew 24. And Josephus continues, "It is therefore impossible to go distinctly over every other instance of these men's iniquity. I shall therefore speak my mind here at once briefly, that neither did any other city ever suffer such miseries, nor did any age ever breed a generation more fruitful in wickedness than this was from the beginning of the world." That's Josephus describing the fall of Jerusalem after it happened. Here's Jesus describing it before it happened. "For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, nor shall ever be." Isn't that just about what Josephus just said? And that was Jesus talking about it before it happened in Matthew 24, 21. So that's one reason Josephus is referenced a lot. The other is that he talks, as I said, talks about a lot of the people in the Bible, the Herods, for example. Of the various political figures in the Gospel and in Acts, Herod the Great and his descendants are the most prominent. Four generations of Herods are mentioned in the New Testament. King Herod the Great ruled all of Palestine at the time of Jesus' birth. After Herod the Great died in 4 BC, his kingdom was divided by Augustus and given to three of his sons. None were granted the official title of king, though, as their father had had. Archelaus became the ethnarch, or the national ruler, and was given Judea, Samaria, and the coast. He was hated by everybody. He was hopelessly incompetent. He was removed by Rome in AD 6. And Antipas governed Jesus' home region of Galilee for more than 40 years throughout Jesus' life, along with the region of Perea across the Jordan River. It was this tetrarch, or ruler of a quarter, who executed John the Baptist and befriended Pontius Pilate at the death of Christ, the crucifixion. Philip was made tetrarch of the more remote parts, the eastern parts of Palestine. His only claim to fame in the New Testament is a mention in the Gospels that his wife Herodias had been taken by his brother Antipas. Herod Agrippa I was a grandson of Herod the Great. He ruled over Herod the Great's entire former empire for 4 years, but 41 to 44, AD 41-44. He executed James. He imprisoned Peter. Agrippa II, the son of Agrippa I, was king of the former territories of Philip in northeastern Palestine from 53 to 59, or 93, I think. This was the king Agrippa who, while visiting the new Roman governor in Caesarea, interviewed Paul and found him innocent of any serious charge. The importance of Josephus can be seen in that brief sketch, because we could not have said much of that without Josephus' help. Certainly we could have filled in the parts where I mentioned what they'd done in the New Testament. But as far as the dates and what they were doing and how they were ruling and how they got there and how they were related, that comes from Josephus. Much of that does. Let's look a little more detail about what Josephus has to say about some of those rulers. Herod the Great. In the struggle for the Roman Empire between Octavius and Antony, Herod supported Antony and his famous mistress, Cleopatra. And you can read about that in Josephus, or you could watch the movie with Elizabeth Taylor. But either way, in Josephus, we discover that Herod plotted to kill Cleopatra and that Cleopatra plotted to kill Herod. They were both plotting to kill each other. The Antiquities of the Jews tells us all about it, how Herod was plotting to kill him. His friends talked him out of it. They said, look, Antony would never bear it, he said. So Herod decides not to kill Cleopatra. So in return, Cleopatra tries to kill Herod by persuading Antony to send him against the Arabs and have her general set a trap for him there. Herod, though, escaped the plot by rousing his army with a great speech, which Josephus gives in great detail. Antony was defeated. Herod went to see Octavius dressed as a commoner and pleaded for mercy, which he was granted. All that's in Josephus. And after that, he remained king over Palestine. And that's where he was when Jesus was born. When Jesus was born, the wise man visited Herod at his palace in Jerusalem. Josephus tells us what that palace looked like. He has a very lengthy description of the towers and the beauty and the size. He goes through all the detail of what that palace looked like. That's where the wise men came to see Herod. Well, what about Herod's character? After all, this was the king who ordered the slaughter of the baby boys in Bethlehem and the surrounding region in Matthew chapter 2. We wouldn't really expect him to have too much on the character scale, would we? Well, let's see what Josephus says. Josephus says that whenever Herod left town, he left instructions that his wife was to be killed if anything happened to him. Earlier, he had killed his wife's brother and father, and eventually he put her to death along with two of their own sons. Later, Herod killed another son and said at that time that no one who thirsts for my blood will escape, not even if judgment finds all of my children guilty. At which point, Augustus, the Roman emperor, said that he would rather be Herod's swine than Herod's son. Before he died, Herod assembled the leading men from all over Judea and ordered that they all be killed as soon as he was dead. In that way, he knew they would mourn after he died. Someone would, anyway. That order was never carried out, though, because Herod's sister had the men released after Herod's death. You know, some people wonder why Josephus does not mention Herod's murder of the children in Bethlehem, which he does not mention that. Of all the things that Herod did, I mean, it is so sad to say. If I described that to you, you would think, well, that must be the worst thing he ever did. As horrible as that was, it was just an average day for King Herod. Sadly. Also, Bethlehem was a very small town. It probably didn't attract a whole lot of attention to King Herod. He probably didn't care much. Josephus didn't care much. What is clear from Josephus is that Herod was willing to do anything to maintain his rule. And if Herod was willing to kill his own children to maintain his rule, do you think he would pause 1 second in killing someone else's child to maintain his rule? That's clear in Josephus. Pilate is mentioned in Josephus. When Archelaus was sent to exile, his territory was placed under Roman rule. It was annexed to the Roman province of Syria. Of the 14 governors who ruled Judea prior to the outbreak of the revolt, AD 66, only three are mentioned in the New Testament. Pilate, Felix, and Festus. We're going to look briefly at what Josephus has to say about Pilate, who ruled from 26 to 36. First, we have two episodes that give us a glimpse of how Pilate was cruel. also. When Pilate first arrived in Judea, he arranged to have the standard of the emperor Tiberius, which had these sculpted images all over it, brought into Jerusalem at night. Well, of course, when the Jews saw this, they immediately saw it as a violation of the Second Commandment, and they responded accordingly. Here's how Josephus describes it in the War of the Jews. Now Pilate, who was sent as procurator into Judea by Tiberius, sent by night those images of Caesar that are called incense into Jerusalem. This excited a very great tumult among the Jews when it was day. For those that were near them were astonished at the sight of them, as indications that their laws were trodden underfoot. For those laws do not permit any sort of image to be brought into the city. Nay, besides the indignation which the citizens themselves had at the procedure, a vast number of people came running out of the country. These came zealously to Pilate, to Caesarea, and besought him to carry those images out of Jerusalem and to preserve their ancient laws inviolable. But upon Pilate's denial of their request, they fell down prostrate upon the ground and continued immovable in that posture for 5 days and five nights. On the next day, after that period, Pilate sat in his tribunal in the open market, likely where he was sitting when we get to the events of the crucifixion, same spot, and called to him the multitude and wanted them to give him an answer. And then he was going to give a signal to his soldiers that they should encompass them, draw their weapons, and kill the Jews right there. So the band of soldiers stood around the Jews in three ranks to threaten to kill them, hoping that would make them, you know, relent. So what did the Jews do? They all stood there and they bared their necks to the sword, said, fine, just kill us, just kill us. Well, Pilate backed down, and the incense, the images were taken out of the city. That's when he arrived. I mean, how's that for a first day on the job, right? I mean, that's how he got started there in Jerusalem. There's a second instance in Josephus where Pilate was not so agreeable in the end, and let me read you that part. After this, he raised another disturbance, that's Pilate, by expending that sacred treasure which is called Corban upon aqueducts, whereby he brought water from the distance of 400 furlongs. At this the multitude had great indignation, and when Pilate was come to Jerusalem, they came about his tribunal and made a clamor at it. Now when he was apprised aforehand of this disturbance, he mixed his own soldiers in their army with the multitude, ordered them to conceal themselves as private men, not indeed to use their swords, but with their staves to beat those that made the clamor. He then gave the signal for them to do so. The Jews were so badly beaten that many of them perished because of the beating. That may have been the instance of the Galilean Jews whose Pilate mingled with their sacrifices in Luke 13, 1 and 2. That's a possibility, because these events usually occurred during festivals when sacrifices would have been given. So that may very well have been what we see in Luke chapter 13. This murder by Pilate of some of Herod's subjects may have also caused the enmity between Pilate and Herod that we read about in the gospel accounts. Pilate is also mentioned in the Antiquity of the Jews, where we find a very famous passage in which Josephus wrote about Jesus. Here's what he said. This is from Josephus. Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him. For he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians, so named from him, are not extinct to this day. That's from Josephus. That passage is called the Testimonium Flavinium, the testimony of Flavius Josephus. It's been the topic of a lot of controversy, as you can imagine. I think most accept it as basically authentic. Some argue that maybe there's been some external influence on the text here and there. I think it's the real deal, is what I think. I think that's Josephus telling us what was going on at the time. And no one living there at that time could have been unaware of Christ and what was happening in Jerusalem. Of course, that happened before Josephus was born, but he came along just a few years after the crucifixion, so he certainly would have heard about that. Pilate was removed from office the year before Josephus was born, in fact, and Josephus, again, undoubtedly grew up hearing all of these stories and tales and things. Josephus also mentions John the Baptist. He does that in the Antiquities of the Jews. Here's what he says. Now, some of the Jews thought that the destruction of Herod's army came from God, and that very justly is a punishment of what he did against John, that was called the Baptist. For Herod slew him, who was a good man, and commanded the Jews to exercise virtue, both as to righteousness toward one another, and piety toward God, and to come to baptism, for that the washing would be acceptable to him if they made use of it, not in order to the putting away of sins, of some sins, but for the purification of the body. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. Supposing still that the soul was thoroughly purified beforehand by righteousness. Now when others came in, crowds about him, for they were greatly moved by hearing his words, Herod, who feared lest the great influence John had over the people might put it into his power and inclination to raise a rebellion, thought it best by putting him to death to prevent any mischief he might cause and not bring himself into difficulties by sparing a man who might make him repent of it when it would be too late. Accordingly, he was sent a prisoner out of Herod's suspicious temper to Machaerus, the castle, and was put there to death. Now the Jews had an opinion that the destruction of this army was sent as a punishment upon Herod, a mark of God's displeasure against him. Josephus's accounts adds two details to the Gospel's accounts of John the Baptist's death. First, Josephus tells us that in addition to fearing John's moral message, Antipas feared John's political motivations as well, perhaps regarding his preaching of a coming kingdom. Also, Josephus tells us where John was put to death. Now, that part where I said we're going to come back to, you'll notice that Josephus' description there says that John's baptism was not for remission of sins, but was intended to cleanse the body after forgiveness had already been obtained. Well, I mean, I don't have to tell you, the Calvinists leap on that like you wouldn't believe. And so let me say a couple of things about it. First, it's possible to translate that passage differently. It's possible that the passage is actually saying that repentance precedes baptism, not salvation preceding baptism. And we know repentance does precede baptism. So that's possibly what the passage says anyway. The second thing we need to keep in mind throughout tonight's lesson, something I mentioned at the beginning, and that is that Josephus is not inspired. Josephus' writings are not inspired. And if they say that salvation precedes baptism, then Josephus is just as wrong as Calvin and the rest of the people who say that. Because we have the inspired word of God that says the opposite, Mark 16:16, Acts 22:16. So we shouldn't be concerned about that at all. One interesting point here is that although Josephus was certainly not inspired, as I've said, he testified to the inspiration of the Old Testament in his writings against Appian. Here's what he wrote. For we have not an innumerable multitude of books among us, disagreeing from and contradicting one another as the Greeks have, but only 22 books which contain the records of all the past times which are justly believed to be divine. The 22 there comes from the prophets were often combined into one book. So that's why the count is different from the count that we have. Josephus also mentions James, the brother of Jesus. He mentions James in the Antiquities. And here's what he writes. When therefore Ananus was of this disposition, he thought he had now a proper opportunity to exercise his authority. Festus was now dead, and Albinus was but upon the road. So he assembled the Sanhedrin of judges and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others. And when he had formed an accusation against them as breakers of the law, he delivered them to be stoned. That passage from Josephus tells us several interesting things. First, it confirms James's position as a leading figure in the early church. Second, he introduces James first as the brother of Jesus, and only afterward does he give the name James. The brother of Jesus comes first in the description. I think that may provide the best support for that earlier description of Christ. Josephus is referring back to something. We must have already met Jesus by the time he gets here, and that's because he'd already mentioned Jesus. So I think that tells us, in fact, that earlier passage was authentic in Josephus. Third thing it tells us is that James was killed for violating the law. Well, since from Acts 21 we know that James was very careful to continue observing the law, if there was any truth to that charge, it was probably because others were violating the law that were somehow associated with James. And fourth, Josephus seems to indicate that the Sadducees were the most offended by the church's teaching. That fits well, doesn't it, with Acts chapter 4 and Acts chapter 5, where in fact it's the Pharisees who are trying to prevent the Sadducees from taking action. Let's talk about another group that Josephus had a few things to say about, and those are the Essenes. The origin of the Essenes are not known. It's speculated that they may be traced back as far as the Babylonian captivity. Others feel they may have developed in Palestine as a result of the growing Greek influence. The Dead Sea Scrolls, as I mentioned, which was the greatest archaeological find of all time. Dead Sea Scrolls, greatest archaeological find of all time. That came from the Essenes. They are the ones who had prepared and stored those scrolls in those caves. Josephus introduces the Essenes by saying they have a reputation for cultivating peculiar sanctity. He says they lived a very serious and somber life, and they had great love for each other, as they did for the other Jews. Josephus tells us they shunned pleasures as a vice. They regarded temperance and the control of the passions as a special virtue. As a rule, they disdained marriage for themselves. They did not allow women into their community. Josephus says they despised riches. They had equality of possessions in which no one was too rich and no one was too poor. They held their possessions in common. Josephus says that they considered oil to be defiling. He doesn't explain that one. They lived in communities outside the city, by those caves where they hid these scrolls, in fact. At one time, they numbered 4,000. Keep in mind, Josephus was an Essene. He joined the Essenes as a teenager and didn't leave till he was 26. So he knows about the Essenes. Very interesting what he says about the Essenes. I won't take the time to read the excerpts on them, but it's an interesting study. Now, there's been a lot of speculation about the links between the Essenes and John the Baptist, and the links, if any. I mean, I'm not saying there are links, but speculation about possible links between the Essenes even and Christ. Without Josephus, without the Dead Sea Scrolls, we wouldn't even know there was such a thing as an Essene. That's how we know about the Essenes. Of course, one immediate question is why there is no direct mention of Essenes in the New Testament. Why don't we have the Sadducees, Pharisees, and the Essenes? I mean, where are the Essenes? Well, first, they were remote. They weren't in the city. Second, they lived very quiet lives, secluded by themselves. They had very little opportunity to get into conflict with Christ. So I think that's why they nearly never come up. Plus, as I read what they believed, they might not have had much conflict with Christ to begin with, right? I mean, a lot of that was what we see in fact of the early church. I think the second is that in fact, their own simple and virtuous lifestyle, I think they wouldn't have had many quarrels with Jesus. That they, I think, lived very upright lives. Now, the works of Josephus shed a lot of light on some New Testament passages, and I've got a big long list here, but I'll see if I can go through a couple before we run out of time. Of the Galileans, where Jesus, of course, began his ministry, Josephus writes that they were always fond of innovations, and they were by nature disposed to change, and they delighted in seditions. I mean, that's a pretty good group if you're going to start a revolution, right? And that's where this started, in Galilee. Of the land itself, Josephus says it was rich in soil and pasturage, produced all sorts of trees, very productive, agriculture. Everywhere it was tilled, it was never idle, always productive. Of course, what do we see throughout the parables? We see all that farming and all that agriculture and all those things in the parables. Many passages deal with fishermen on the Sea of Galilee. Josephus tells us there were 9 populous cities on the shore of Galilee, only one of which, Tiberias, remains today. Josephus said that in his day there were 300 plus boats sailing around on that lake. Josephus tells us about the Zealots, which of course tell us something about Simon the Zealot. Josephus tells us about the Sabbath and the importance of the Sabbath. And in fact, that's how Pompey was able to take Jerusalem. He would attack on the Sabbath, and the Jews would not take any effort to defend themselves because it was the Sabbath. And he took the city because of that. And we read about that in Josephus. Josephus confirms that demon possession existed in New Testament times. He gives an elaborate description of someone possessed by a demon in the New Testament times. In Matthew 13:44, Jesus said the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure that is hid in a field. Josephus tells us that Jews often stored all their gold and their silver underground out in the field. How many Jews would have been in Jerusalem during Passover at the time of Christ? Josephus tells us. He says there could have been as many as 2.75 million people in Jerusalem at that time. Huge, huge numbers of people. In Mark 12, Jesus accused the experts in the law of devouring widows' houses. Josephus tells us that some rabbis had convinced certain people, especially widows, that there was no greater honor than supporting a rabbi in comfort, and that doing that would guarantee blessings in the age to come. That sounds like a tele-rabbi, right? Instead of a tele-evangelist. There's a lot in Josephus, and I would encourage you to take a look at that. And when you're studying your Bible and you're using those Bible dictionaries, as you should, a lot of that information that's not in the Bible is coming from Josephus. So it's very much a worthwhile study. I have another class, which I may get to do some point, on the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are fascinating, and that's a good lead-in from here. So anyway, one of these days we may get to look at those. I hope you found this interesting. I love studying stuff like this, and I hope you do as well. Let's end with a closing prayer.